Podcast Guys takes a long view and a long price. Spoilers will be commonplace. Listen at your own risk. Sorry, just a moment. Okay. Good morning, faithful reader.
Welcome, fortunate seeker.
This is Podcast Guys Talking Erratic Errata.
Podcast Guys Talking Erratic Errata is a whirlwind reread of A Practical Guide to Evilware.
A historian reporting live from Marchford.
And a literature scholar scrying in from a secure location warded beyond speech.
Tackle the big questions about one of the greatest novels of the age, such as...
Are demons just full of horse teeth?
Is the hunter okay?
And are any of these lazy legionaries going to actually help the named fight?
Nobody wants to get corrupted anymore.
Oh, give me a bloodthirsty, fire and brimstone conquering villain any day. It's the schemers you have to watch out for. Queen Elizabeth Alban of Callow.
Sorry, I didn't quite catch what happened when I left last time. Where are we?
The horse pet gave birth to a baby that was a human-ish, but was really a demon. And now we're fighting a demon.
Still?
Well, prior to this, we were fighting a puppet and a horse, I guess. The legionaries were fighting a horse while the named were fighting a puppet. All the named are here to fight a demon directly, which is probably safe. But
no.
This whole chapter, barring the last paragraph or so, two paragraphs, is basically just a cage match between the named we like plus Hunter and a demon. And it goes okay, all things considered.
Wow. Probably because they've got heroes here to save the day.
Weirdly, yeah.
Sorry, hero.
Right. Hunter is surprisingly effective, although maybe not super surprisingly, since theoretically heroes are what you need to defeat demons. But the opening line of this chapter is Kat just absolutely dragging heroes generally and Hunter specifically, because she says, "Before I could properly process the sight of a hero actually being helpful for once," and then she talks about some magical stuff happening, but just the opening line is, "Yeah, heroes are normally bad, but you know what? This one's doing all right today."
How many has Catherine actually met? Just the one band of five?
Yes.
That she's trounced repeatedly? Especially that useless bard.
Yeah, but I'm sure she's heard a lot of stories from Black.
Yeah, she would have a dim view of heroes. But maybe she should have a dim view of people on her own side?
What?
Yeah, she's, because she's got a demon that appeared. And, you know, what would you do if a demon suddenly was near you?
Die? Be corrupted?
Both good answers. I was going for run. But you know what Catherine can't do?
What can Catherine not do?
Run. Because her conniving second-in-command, Juniper, traps her in this box with the demon. Wards go down all around them.
That seems sensible.
Maybe if Catherine had been briefed on it, but she has no idea. She says, well, of course Juniper had a contingency in case the demon actually showed up. Shouldn't the person in charge of the Legion be aware of the demon contingency?
I mean, Juniper's technically in charge of the Legion directly, but yeah, it is interesting, especially since Catherine works it out and in the end agrees that Juniper's idea was the right one, because maybe Catherine would get corrupted and they would need to trap and fight her in a level of contingency creation that, one, feels like a bit much, and two, Juniper's plan was to do a ward around a demonically corrupted named, and...
I appreciate...
Well, and that's rough enough, but add on to that, that she thinks the difference maker here is we can't let Catherine know Because if she gets corrupted, then the demon will know, or then Catherine, the evil Catherine, will know the plan. And that's enough of a loss of edge that this won't work anymore. I don't know.
It wouldn't work long anyway.
Right.
And also, Catherine's shown herself to be extremely resistant to the demon's powers.
Well.
Catherine's shown herself to be extremely subject to the demon's powers.
I don't want to act like Juniper is being dumb here or that she's made a mistake. I think that she is.
Juniper always makes the best choice. It's her biggest weakness.
Right. I think what's going on here is Juniper is using what information she has about demons, which is probably pretty little for her station. No, a lot for her station, a little for the situation she's in. But I think she's making the decision to create the best odds possible, even if she knows they're not good odds. And maybe that's all you can do.
Well, that and have a few secret weapons up your sleeve. Because, you know, when they fight the Dead King, they have those special light-based charges they can throw out at the undead.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a special charge to throw out at the demon if the worst case were to happen. Because Catherine notices another very powerful resource is missing. Robert. Which is hilarious to me because Juniper's reached a point where, we put a paper bag over the demon, wait for it to break its way out, and while we do, get some goblins ready. The best goblins. But
yeah,
it's not a great situation. Also, she's napping, so she doesn't know.
I mean, yeah. Having goblins on hand, who knows? Maybe alchemy is particularly effective here, or maybe goblin fire is?
If that were the case, Catherine would have won this 3 chapters ago.
That's fair.
But Catherine's not fighting alone. She has Hakram, and she has Masego, and she has this cute girl.
Mm-hmm. And also Hunter. Don't forget the only hero here. Hero is his name now. Hunter is doing well, but he's also being really weird. He just, in the middle of this fight, shouts out, "Feel the might of my wrath, Hellspawn." Was he this weird always? I feel like yes, but does he step it up a notch against the demon?
It's a big cinematic combat, but Catherine still has agency, so it means it's one of those, cutscenes kind of turned back into a battle. So what she has here is a powerful NPC ally, and they always have a catchphrase before each of their attacks.
Sure.
After yelling this, Hunter does his attack. You see a big 546 flash up on the demon, and he just falls back into a little bouncy ready stance until it's his turn again.
That makes sense. Related to that,
yes, the bells are jingling.
Good, thank you. Do heroes, I almost hate to ask, do heroes get more effective in combat when they shout nonsense like this?
You'll hate the answer because I have a feeling.
Does creation appreciate when they so firmly fall into the archetype and reward them for it? Because I kind of hate that.
Does reality reward falling into archetype in the archetype book?
Yeah, I know. It's awful, but it legitimately, you are rewarded for shouting, "Feel the might of my wrath, Hellspawn."
Well, take it with E.E. and the terrible and bad world he wrote, apparently. According to my co-host, he said it. Everyone despise him.
Oops.
Catherine also doesn't like the heroic declarations, but, she tells us, "I wasn't about to look this useful of a gift horse in the mouth." Looking a gift horse in the mouth is a Calwyn version of the much more common phrase, "looking the invisible tiger in the stripes." At least if you're from the Empire of Praise. Looking the man-eating tapir in the runaway from them. The joke here is that Calwyns are provincial horse people.
They love horses, yeah. And horse mouths, apparently.
And mud, but that isn't really mentioned here.
Maybe the horse has mud in its mouth?
Actually, it has a whole bunch of light in its face.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, the Deuter grasps for the hero, and there's a violent explosion of blinding light. But interestingly, light here is all lowercase, which could mean a number of things. It might not be the, so to speak, divine element of light, but rather just Hunter does something, which, you know, is vaguely divinely sourced because he's a hero, but it's not specifically a divine moment, and light is a coincidental byproduct. Or Catherine doesn't really know about light yet, but it's lowercase, and I think that's really interesting, and I like the chance to go analyze a single word.
Yeah, I think it's probably just supposed to be descriptive here rather than, I don't know, defining what type of magic it is, but yeah.
If it even is magic.
I suppose.
Maybe Hunter has a flashlight.
You're right, my bad.
No, it's flashlight, all lowercase.
Very important distinction.
But it kills the demon. There's nothing left but its mirror. So the demon starts reforming from all the corrupted stuff around, including some of Catherine's legionaries.
Oh no.
And Catherine looks over at Nock and indicates those soldiers with an inclined head and draws a finger across her throat, which is sensible.
Mm-hmm.
They need to be executed. This is not the time for mercy. There is no room for mercy. They are already dead. But the finger across the throat is so very blunt, which I think demonstrates the battlefield they're on, because communicating to a competent underling, hey, do the obvious step, doesn't necessarily require spelling out the obvious step, but there is no room for time or subtlety here. Finger across the throat them.
There's also potentially an efficiency and morale component here. This way, there's no confusion from anyone down the line, including those who have to use the crossbows here. This order is coming from the top. This is coming from the named and from our commander.
Rather than Nock staging a coup at this exact moment.
Well, I mean, it's not just about Nock staging a coup or whatever, but it's probably easier to assume that the person with the name has some level of understanding that maybe the average foot soldier doesn't, and so they may be more willing to just say, well, chain of command, I gotta do this, and also, well, she's the expert, gotta do this, coming directly from her, you know, making it clear like this. So there might be a layer to this that's more than just simply a weird, morbid, I'm drawing my finger across my throat to, you know, to indicate we need to execute the soldiers here.
That is true. If my boss told me to kill you, it would be a different thing than if Joe Biden showed up and told me to kill you.
Exactly.
And I wouldn't listen to either.
No, thank you. So, these guys and gals and everyone else involved, the flesh just sort of is like flaking away from them and slides to the ground in trickles.
Guys, gals, and non-binary flesh trickles.
Yeah. And that's what causes Catherine to say, let's kill these soldiers. And then these flecks of flesh that are on the ground sort of slither together into a, as Kat describes it, foul pile. In fact, some sort of foul pile. And then they coalesce into a larger form. I don't really have a lot to say here. I don't think there's a lot to dig into. I just want to say, gross.
But Catherine's ready. There's a demon around, and she says, apprentice, can you banish it? Which is definitely a great plan C, Catherine. And his response to, can you banish the demon, the super powerful mega bad thing that people can't even study without being destroyed? The response to that is just, not from inside the threshold. He can just banish the demon?
Oh yeah, the implication is, can you banish it? Yes, in a different circumstance. And not even that different of one, just a different location.
Inside, oh yeah, if I had a coven of 15 of the greatest mages in Calurnia, 24 hours inside the ritual, no, just, yeah, I could. I can't, but I could.
The only thing preventing me from doing that right now is the very magical, the very ritual that I set up previously. So, yeah. It does, there very well may be more to it. It may be not from within inside the threshold. That's the first layer of no, I can't. If they weren't in the threshold, he may say, I could, but I need 30 minutes. Or I could if you're willing to sacrifice 10 people and let me use their, you know, whatever nonsense.
Yeah, use the one Nox killing, quickly.
Yeah, hurry. Yeah, so it could be that's just the biggest obstacle, but it could be the only one, I don't know.
But we don't know all the details about demons, and also I accuse Catherine of not knowing anything.
Oh.
Not because she's Callowin, I mean partially, but mostly because she's Catherine.
Sure.
She wonders if the demon had planned being in the threshold so it can't be banished, and dismisses it at first, kind of, because demons shouldn't even be intelligent, but this one had proved capable of deception. Then again, so are animals. Anyhow, who knew what being bound to an imperial standard for a few hundred years could do to a creature like that? And she's applying devil logic to a demon, right? Devils wax slowly in intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
But demons are fundamentally different creatures, even though I see why they're associated in the minds of, you know, Catherine and co. But I think this is just Catherine conflating things that seem like they should be the same category.
Yeah.
Demons are not really related to devils.
Right. So it does then force us to look at why this demon is being clever, if that is what's happening here, since that's unexpected. And I'm wondering if that's just that, typically speaking, demons don't need to be clever, so they hide that.
Or people are just wrong about demons, because...
Yeah, also true.
You know.
Because, let's see, we're looking at a type of creature, might even be a stretch, an entity where some of them you can't think about or interact with because they make things not there, and some of them corrupt you if you study them, so, like, yeah, not great, not easy to dig in on.
Also.
Also?
I hope I don't go too far by saying I think demons are a big threat, typically.
Mm-hmm.
They could level a city sometimes.
Sure.
I live in a world where there are threats that can level a city. It's called man's hubris, slash the bomb. And I live in a country that was super scared about the bomb for a long time, but don't worry, we are not worried about it anymore, because they got rid of all the nukes in the world. But back in the 70s, they did drills for, you know, if there is a nuclear war coming, get under your desk. People can just be really wrong about city-destroying threats that don't actually show up.
That's fair. So you're saying demons are like nuclear weapons.
And if you get under your desk, they can't hurt you.
Right.
Just wash off the radiation.
I'm sitting next to a desk right now, and this demon is still somehow hurting me a bit. Because we get a description of what the demon turns into. It used to, you know, it was the child form, and it got messed up, so it upgraded. It's now the size of a two-story house.
That wasn't even its final form?
Right, exactly. It's on these, like, clawed legs and articulations supporting the torso.
Okay, you're kind of a coward if that's all that's bothering you.
It's got fingers that are human-like. And then Catherine is not concerned. Catherine is thinking that it's not going to bother creating for itself a head in this form, because it might not need it. But then we get this. A long, thin strand of skin formed and started dangling from the torso. And Catherine realizes she was wrong about it not having a head. Because at the end of the strand, a bubble of flesh expanded, sprouting eyes by the dozens that were set in dark, purpled flesh. Muscles popped from underneath the bubble and grew large, horse-like teeth. And I know I said this earlier, but I just want to repeat and make sure it's on the record. Gross. Also, it makes some fun sounds.
Oh, yeah. When a bit gets chopped off of it, just a little thing, a limb, it picks it up and shoves it into where its spine maybe should be. And with a wet squelch, the severed limb rejoined the hole. And, you know, I think I have to echo your reaction and just say, that is tasty.
It would be pretty cool to be able to just stick your arm onto your spine for some extra support.
You're really going to just let the audience know that you're old and feeble?
It would be really cool if old people could do that, what I just described. I was asking for a friend.
Oh, okay. How's your back?
So, Hunter and Catherine and Z's, we're all lined up here. We're fighting this thing. They're trying to figure out what to do.
They're friends.
Apprentice has a plan. He's working on some sort of ritual that he thinks will hurt it enough that Hunter can finish it off. There's a lot going on here. And then Hunter has a couple of lines here, and I just want to deliver these, because this guy, this hero, is a lot. Catherine's delivering a plan. She's talking about what we need to do. And Hunter's response is, "Squire, you are only slightly less of a blight upon creation than this thing," which is, I would say, pretty objectively false. And
also not the time.
Right. And then as they share the plan, he's willing to go with the plan, but he has to make sure that he's in charge, and he lets Catherine know in a very Hunter fashion, "I'll take the lead, minion of dark." Like, just, you could just say, "Let me go first, I've got a spear, or let me go first, I can hurt this thing. There's so many options here besides just, I'll take the lead, minion of Dark. He's just a lot.
Hey, but Dark is capitalized here? Who is Dark?
You know, the vague evil that commands all the villains, apparently.
I mentioned a couple of weeks ago when we did the prologue that when I first started reading this story, someone being called the Black Knight or just plain Ranger bothered me. It didn't seem to flow. It seemed like a child telling a story about their stuffed animals. Bear does this. Raccoon does that. Great. And I got over it real fast. It works. It just takes adjustment.
Sure.
But Minion of Dark.
Uh-huh.
I think E.E. was right to not make the Dread Empire governed by Dark, or, you know, have Catherine become first under Dark. Though the Dark King would work. It's worse than the Dead King. But it would work. It would flow. Which is to say, everything I just said is still right. Minion of Dark.
Yeah.
However,
mm-hmm.
Speaking of misreading the situation, as I did in the first episode of the podcast, Adjutant is also slightly left of correct. Or rather, slightly right. Because again, we know that he is currently all right.
Oof.
When Hunter's being, I want to say very rude, but really just like embarrassingly crudely rude, and not crude in the boorish sense, but rather just, this is cobbled together.
Mm-hmm.
Adjutant says, you know he has another hand, right? So technically, implying you could cut it off again, Catherine. And you know who else has another hand, Hakram? You know who has, be able to lose another hand? Have you heard of foreshadowing?
Yeah, this whole scene where Catherine says that she wants to cut off Hunter's hand twice, which, come on. Yeah, there's a lot going on here for sure.
No, also, you do live in a magical world. I'm sure if you tried hard enough, you could find someone to Prometheus him.
That
Prometheus, for those who are unaware, was a character in Portal 2, whom we are told was punished for giving the gift of knowledge to man. He was cast into the bowels of the earth and pecked by birds. I remember that line very clearly.
I mean, that sounds pretty unpleasant.
Or maybe it's Portal 1? No, it's gotta be Portal 2, right?
Gotta be.
Yeah. It's in the scene where you've got all the conveyor belts with the broken little shooty guys. Also, completely non-controversial take of the day, GLaDOS did nothing wrong. She is a girl boss. She can gatekeep and nerve gas, as they say. Gatekeep, nerve gas, girl boss.
So true.
So Hunter just goes wheeling back into combat. He's got his spear, which we know is a bad weapon because swords are cool and good and spears are amateur and lame.
Right.
That's why historically most people use swords.
Mm-hmm.
But his spear is wreathed in light. He keeps poking this big bad boy. And Catherine realizes that heroic names must have been painful to the monster. And you know I'm not sold on the idea that demons can only be destroyed by a heroic name. I don't deny it, but I don't think we have the body of evidence to be sure of it. And I still don't see why demons should necessarily be more susceptible to the good side of a reality that never should have been as far as they're concerned, as opposed to the evil, because, you know, which court of the Fae are more anathema to humankind?
I've been thinking about this, and I wonder if it's just as simple as light has a purifying effect. Not any sort of moral or ethical stance, just light is purifying. And
okay.
That's like the... If you have to have like a metaphysical thing here, it might just be that. The other side of it might simply be, if you're telling a story about someone fighting a demon, it's a hero. And
thereby, the heroes can fight the demons.
Right. It's probably a mixture of both of those things, frankly. Or it very well could be that because that's how the story works, light can purify demons, you know?
Fantastic. However, I think it's also funny that Catherine decides that heroic names must be painful to the monster, when what's going on is he's stabbing and chopping up the thing. Like, spoiler, she's going to start stabbing and chopping up the thing, and it will react negatively to that as well.
Yep.
So, you know, I don't care if... people are hard. Who's a person that would just read as good and also be pretty decent?
but not be a hero? Or do you mean like a real life person?
Because at the end of the day, whether Fred Hampton or Richard Nixon is poking me with a needle, the needle will hurt. Though admittedly, I would trust Fred has a point. He tended to. Nixon would be doing it out of homophobia.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't shake my hand because that would give him AIDS based on what he said about San Francisco. That man is, again, the Nixon tapes, wild ride. Terrible stuff. Nasty as all get out. But they yeah. are a ride.
Content warning. Nixon says things in them.
He has some interesting views on gender.
Oh, I bet.
And I don't mean this one. I mean, I'm sure he has some very toxic negative ones. He has some very interesting views on... He has an interesting history of gender identity, which he clearly never examined.
Yeah, that checks out. Not which, like, this isn't some kind of, like, transvestigation or whatever, but, like, that checks out in the he never examined.
Most cis folks, I say as one, actually do have a more complex relationship with gender than we are led to believe we should believe. But, you know...
So, yeah, the preacher is ignoring Catherine for now. But Catherine...
So she's safe.
Right. Catherine can't ignore it, though, because she's limping close to be able to fight it, maybe. And I use limping here because she does, not because I feel the need to call out her blown-up leg or whatever happened. And she can just feel the corruption wafting off the demon and creeping at the edge of her mind.
I like the word wafting.
It's a rough one, yeah.
But, like...
It's good, yeah.
Billow? Are there waves but not exactly. steady? Or?
It gives an unsteady edge to the range of the corruption that I really like for something like a demon.
In my high school chemistry lab, and I assume this is actually typical among lab classes, but I only have my own experience, we were told you don't stick your nose into a vial or Bunsen burner or bomb and yeah. just sniff. You have to waft it, right?
Right.
You need to waft the... And I'm just imagining Masego in one of his horrible classes advising people to waft the demon scent, you know?
Yeah.
You don't want to just get a face full of corruption, but waft it over. See if you can identify how it's eroding your very existence.
But important here, or maybe not important, but curious to me, Hunter is all up in this thing's business and seems to be okay for now. Obviously, it's a process. Catherine is near it and instantly is feeling this. It's creeping at the edge of her mind. Are heroes, in addition to being capable of slaying demons, are they resistant to the effects of demons? More so than normal people? More so than villains? And as a potential alternative to that, or addition to that, is Catherine now particularly vulnerable to a corruption demon? I know that everything was excised, but that also leaves a ragged edge, I would imagine.
Yeah, ectomies can be life-saving, but something did get ectomed.
So on a scale of like...
I hardly know him.
You know, who's most vulnerable to the corruption? Is it Hunter the least and then Ranger? Or, Ranger? Huh. Spoilers will be commonplace. And then Archer as a neutral name, and then Hawkram as a normal villain, and Z's as a protected villain, then Hawkram as a normal villain, and then Cat as a broken villain? Is there a tier list here of who's most affected by this demon? Or is it just Hunter is resistant, everybody else is weak? Or is Hunter on everybody else's level and Cat's just weak?
I think... by the same story logics you have before, that is to say, not necessarily naturally occurring, but mythically occurring, which is a natural process, Hunter would be the most resistant, and Catherine obviously got ectomied, so she's the weakest. But Masego is going to be in a weird boat, because he's either going to be unusually well-protected, possibly past Archer, just because he's got will and depths of power and blah, 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 or that's a whole set of vulnerabilities putting him down. And Hawkram has the advantage of being Hawkram, where his identity is both being Catherine's right hand, which is the only one he has right now, and kind of the unbreakable wall. I suspect he would be unusually resistant, just given that's his whole deal. So normally I'd put Archer above any villains, but...
So, my question... about Hunter's susceptibility here stands. We know that they can hurt demons, but
no,
the...
last chapter was stand. No, two chapters ago was stand.
So, but the heroic sacrifice against the Eldritch Abomination is a trope. It could be that heroes have to be, you know, willing to be destroyed by the demon, and maybe they don't resist it particularly. I think that isn't necessarily the case, because this whole discussion was more about Kat's vulnerability in my book, because we do get a bit more information a little later on. Probably some other things to talk about before we get there, but there's, I don't know, a partial answer to this a few paragraphs down.
Not to ignore the fact that you refocus the conversation on Kat, not re as in changed, but restored. But Hunter, again, you say the hero's heroic sacrifice was important, but because of that, I would think there's another reason for them to be resistant, because the story is never going to be the hero fought the demon and became a terrible monster. That could be a story, but that's not the story.
The trope is...
The story is a hero resisted, and then, I don't know, got like a hand bursting through them or something,
sure,
and died heroically.
The trope is death.
Off the top of my head.
Yeah. The stories where a hero is corrupted is more about the fall of the hero than the sacrifice against the Eldritch thing. Heroes should just die, is what you're saying. It's a cleaner thing than that.
I mean, look at the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Okay. I have not read the Epic of Gilgamesh.
I think I did a long time ago, but I've kind of just remembered, you know, they were good friends in a very heterosexual way, and that's all that matters.
That's about what I know about it as well.
Oh, and Utnapishtim.
And
Utnapishtim is a great name, and he had a great boat.
I mean, gotta respect a great boat.
Catherine chops the boy a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And it apparently bleeds. Though it bleeds what the dictionary tells you to pronounce ichor, but I've decided I really am a fan of the less accepted, more modern pronunciation of ichor, because come on. Am I right?
I do prefer ichor.
I know what's prescriptively correct, but also language is a lie, and I have degrees enough that I get to justify myself using polysyllabic words, and therefore you can't make me feel dumb, because I already feel dumb all the time. It's imposter syndrome. But this icky ichor blackens the steel of her sword, and she said she'll worry about that later, which is right. Not the time. As long as it didn't touch my skin, I should be fine. This is what some of our readers may recognize as one of our classic Catherine Foundling completely unfounded guesses hazarded at the risk of her life.
Yeah, I'm beginning to see a trend develop here.
Yeah, so tune in later and we'll see if she makes it.
Hey, I have another question about light and heroes and villains and whatnot.
It's usually associated with heroes.
Hunter gets hit directly by the demon, and his chest instantly starts to warp. And then
I just have to note, because he is the sexiest character in the scene, his bare chest begins to warp.
Sorry, yes, he's naked. And then he bursts with that light, which is described as being violent here, and his flesh is singed by this. It leaves behind only singed flesh. Obviously, if the corruption's in there, you got to do some cauterization, sure. That said, light is often used in these big flashes, and there's often scorching, and it seems like it isn't as focused as other things we see. Do you also feel as though, just vibes-based, that the light, capital L, is broadly speaking less precise than other magic and supernatural power that we see, whether that's the darkness that villains wield, or, you know, the sorcery, or anything like that, or night even? It's just the, you throw a big blast of light and things get burnt up and purified, and it hits things that it maybe shouldn't, but they kind of fall into the purify everything and let the gods sort them out later.
Now that you mention it, that sure is the whole thing, isn't it?
Kinda. I mean, it's Tariq's whole thing, obviously. And it's the angel nuke, obviously.
Yeah, which is an extreme case, but also...
I mean, those are both extreme cases, yes.
True. But also in both of their extremitudes, I think the word is, you gotta admit, it's not a case of, oh, we've turned it up past where it's supposed to be, that this is the purest kind of light.
It's not treated as a perversion of the concept of light being used. It's just like, wow, they're powerful, but they are using light. Like, nobody's surprised by it, except
Cordelia,
maybe.
No, you'll kill everyone. Right. Can this possibly be what the choir wants?
Right, yeah, exactly. It's just, yep, that's what you expect from light. The only surprising thing is the scale. So light's just indiscriminate, which I think is sort of the vibe we get throughout this whole thing. It's kind of nasty, huh?
Yeah. I'm not going to go back to Rilke today. But read Rilke, everyone. Dwino Elegies. Great. I do have a question about Hunter doing this.
Okay.
He screams, and another burst of violent light burns away the corruption, leaving only singed flesh. In third grade, I read the word singed in a short story in class aloud, and I said singed, because, you know, it's a third grader.
Sure.
And I was corrected, and I was deeply embarrassed, and I blamed falsely an invented joking pronunciation done by my father, which I then imitated. Therefore, I was not to blame. So,
Powerful,
it's an embarrassment I have carried with me for decades. And now I have confessed, and I'm made pure by the light. When he screams, is it this burns and hurts? The light is burning. It does not burn what you are, but it burns what you are not. Or is it kind of a Dragon Ball Z, rest in peace, scream a lot, and the powers happen?
I kind of took the screaming as a result of his chest warping with corruption.
Ah.
Also,
do you think it hurts to have your chest warp with corruption?
I would imagine so. The burst of light that comes out of him and stinges his chest is described as being violent, so it probably hurt too. Again, it's doing some burning. His chest doesn't feel good right now, I think we can all agree. But the demon is nasty again, and then Catherine starts to consider some strategy here. She says that, in answer to our previous discussion, staying too close wasn't an option for Hawkum or me, given how much more vulnerable to corruption we were.
Hey, wait a minute. More.
Yep. So there's a lot going on here. More vulnerable means the hero is vulnerable to a level. More vulnerable also means that the villains broadly are, but it's not specifically demons necessarily, although that may be the case. It's corruption. And I don't know if that's significant, and I don't know really what to do with that until more demons show up and we can start really paying attention to those details. But we do know at least that when it comes to corruption demons, villains are more vulnerable, up to and including a villain who has an entire aspect about resisting, you know, hit stand. And he's just...
No, this chapter is slight.
Sorry, you're right. Thank you. He's lumped in with Catherine in the category of being not Hunter here. Also, important to note, hero versus villain is the distinction, because Hunter is not, if I had to guess, and based on evidence we have, a particularly light-focused or powerful named. He's Hunter, and he is still more resistant. So it definitely has to be heroes, broadly speaking. He's not like a hero built to fight demons, I don't think, unless that's what the Hunter is, and which would be odd, but, you know.
Demon Hunter.
Right. That would be a weird thing for there to be without there being a demon active when he gets his name.
Well, why do you think there are no demons active right now, other than, obviously?
<That's a> classic.
He just didn't bring it up. He's really humble.
He's killed dozens of demons before this. A follow-up to that, and this is a bit tangential, so I apologize, because we really do try to stay on topic here.
Speaking of...
So, you know how Catherine went into her own soul and the demon was there and it was really bad?
Which was a really bad piece of writing, because there was no way we could possibly have seen that coming.
Right. If Catherine had been a hero in that same position, could she have managed it with the demon that close? Would her aspect have been more protected? Would the demon have not gotten a grip on her in the same way? And as a follow-up, could a non-heroic but non-villainous name like Archer have done the same thing? Obviously, the distinction here seems to be villains are the most vulnerable. is her villainous nature the reason for her aspect needing to get fully excised, or is it anybody except a hero? You know, I'm just wondering exactly where that lines up, and if Catherine made an especially bad decision, or just an actually still always an especially bad decision. It was always bad. There's nothing good about it.
I think she made a universally bad decision that's especially worse in her position.
Good for her.
If that's the only way Catherine acts.
Yeah. Good news, though. Catherine clenches her fingers during this fight.
Oh. Sound effect!
That is finger clench number 20 for the series so far. And this one is a mid-fight clench, which are always fun.
And we might have another coming, because look what the next three words are.
Then unclenched them?
Yeah. She just reloaded.
She's ready for the next clench.
And while Catherine's doing her signature move, Hunter does his, which is be stupid and bold and frankly heroic. He charges in again with a cry. And it was at this point I realized I'm actually very attracted to Hunter.
Uh-oh.
He's stupid, the worst, naked, and brave.
Yeah, that's kind of your whole thing.
Get me a man like that.
Yeah.
So, I'm sorry, everyone, but I will spend the rest of this podcast series, all the way through episode, I don't know, 150 or however far we go, openly lusting over Hunter at all times. So, be ready for that. Every chapter where he shows up, I will not be ashamed.
Hey, you've done a bad thing.
What?
I have to make a note somewhere. And now, in episode 150, we have to say it's our last episode. So the fight goes on a bit. Hunter hunts Catherine, Katz, Hockram, Hawk. I don't know where I'm going with this. We get a cool trick from Archer where the demon is reaching out an arm and she shoots an arrow that she has spin end over end like a scything blade and it slices through an arm. That's pretty cool. I guess there's a reason that she's got an archer name. An archery focused name.
Because of the bow?
Yeah, because of the big bow, yeah. The demon scoops up a bunch of pave stones from the ground and throws them at Z's because he's doing a ritual. Catherine.
Like those rooms in The Legend of Zelda, like the Game Boy games?
Yeah.
Where the tiles come up and fire at you?
It's exactly like Zelda, complete with Catherine shooting a spear of shadows at the stones and shattering them.
Link's Awakening, yeah.
Several made it past that, and then Archer shoots another of these, like, spinning arrows that destroy three paving stones in midair. And by another, I mean three more, because it's described as spinning arrows taking them out. So in the time it takes for rocks to fly across a street or across a plaza here, Archer shoots three arrows that each destroy a big rock out of the air. God, he's cool. And then there's still some coming in.
I can see Catherine's lust building.
Right, exactly. And then Adjutant is there with a shield and blocks the last rock.
Okay, yeah. I mean, that's kind of his thing.
And destroys his shield and breaks his arm.
I'm sorry, what?
Yeah, you know those rocks that arrows were breaking? They broke Hockram.
I really love that this is a story where that's not even for a second, like, I don't really see. No.
No, like, oh, the physics don't make sense. What's going on? It's just, yeah, the archer name is better at shooting things than the administrative assistant name is at taking rocks to the shoulder. That's fine.
A sturdy administrative assistant.
Yes, I know, but. However, here's the thing.
He's a reliable secretary.
Hockram's arm breaks.
Hockram breaks, it's what he does.
He rips his shield off, which is worth noting again, that the legionaries of the Legions of Terror have shields made of steel, so big heavy boys, and destroyed by these rocks. And then Hockram does what you normally do with a broken arm, and forces it back into its socket.
So I never took biology.
Uh-huh.
But
he doesn't. He forces it back into its socket with a horrible cracking sound. He doesn't scream.
No.
He doesn't flinch. He just has his arm broken, shoves it back into place, and then gets back in the fight.
Make this man warlord already.
He's holding his bone in place with sheer muscle, I think.
I do believe it, but.
So that's a rough moment for Hockram.
And apparently the sound of him getting caved in is what wakes Apprentice from his nap. Because now that that's all happened, he's decided to get up and actually participate.
Yeah. And by participate, you do mean do a cool, you know, apprentice moment. He breaks his own ritual, the one that
And then he does
up.
The same spell he did 3 times in a row, I know.
Not quite. First of all, Catherine notes that usurpation is the essence of sorcery, which we hear several times throughout this story. It's great. It's a cool line. And I just want to mention...
That's a good tattoo.
Actually, yeah. It's very cool how many ways this applies. He's, in this instance, usurping his own ritual and refocusing it and rebuilding it on the fly. It's just that line, that description that Apprentice loves here, or that Masego loves, it comes up so frequently, and you can apply it to so many places where magic is being used if you're, you know, thinking about it. And I really like that this isn't just a throwaway line, or that it means one specific thing, because basically anytime there's magic going on, you can see something being usurped, and it's great. I love it.
And he calls down fire from the heavens. Or rather, he calls down fire from the fireplaces.
Mm-hmm.
He makes his spell fail, which will blow up everything in however many yards of every hearth in all of the ritual. Except instead of letting that happen, he eats the fire and burns it onto the demon.
Yep.
And he does what I think any of us would do, and I'm just so proud of my little child, my boy, my son, my precious only and dearest child. There's a strange sound that Catherine hears from by Masego, and she realizes that it was a laugh. Masego was grinning madly as he convulsed in laughter, the glare of the flames reflecting on his glasses as he peered over them at his work. He's just a precious little darling, and he needs to be protected.
He's so good.
And I don't know. How could you not be proud of this child?
Honestly. And Catherine acknowledges that too. She's not sure how long this lasts, and by this I do mean a pillar of flame falling from the skies onto the demon, such that the stone is being scorched and the air is being distorted. And Catherine gives us a great moment here. We get a nod, a thing that I think in this moment you couldn't help but think if you were witnessing this. She thinks of him here as the son of the sovereign of the red skies, proving the truth of his lineage. And, yep, big ol' blast of fire falling down from the sky, making everything glow with how powerful it is. That's awesome. His dad would be proud.
Minimal tangent, really loving that the lineage is not biological and doesn't have to be.
Oh, yeah.
Great. We've mentioned it before, noting it.
Absolutely.
Also, speaking of things we've mentioned before,
mm-hmm.
Hunter got out of the way when the spell happened. Not like in a coward way, but in everybody's fleeing from the magic.
Sure.
And he bursts through a window into a house to do so, because he's the best. And then my beautiful, perfect man bursts out of a different house than the one he'd entered to join everyone.
Okay.
And, I mean, you gotta be a little zany with it. Get a little silly in the fight.
He got knocked through a house and then saw his opportunity, snuck around behind a few houses, and then burst dramatically out through a door. That's great.
Hi, but you weren't expecting me. Oh, you're still doing the fire? But remember, shirtless. But like, yeah. Singed a little so you can see he was in combat.
Right, right, right. Nice and sweaty, like blood on the chest or whatever.
Yeah, but like, you know, Achilles-style glistening with the blood of your enemies.
Yeah, does Hunter just look like Brad Pitt? Is that where we are?
I mean, I wouldn't complain.
Brad Pitt with tribal tattoos.
I don't like what it says about me, but I still wouldn't complain.
Oh, no.
Yeah, we're going to discover a lot about me over the next, you know, well, 80
hey,
chapters or whatever.
You can't say we're going to discover a lot about you. I think you're going to discover... let's see how I want to phrase this. I think the discovery is going to be you realizing what you are willing to say out loud and nothing surprising me.
Instead of reading me, can we just read the story?
Yeah, okay. They are standing here watching the fire. They're wondering if it's going to kill it. Kat says no. They know that they can't banish it, so it's all going to come down to Hunter in the end. You know, there's just some discussion here. There's a lull in the battle while the mage does a constant stream of inferno at the bad guy.
You take a break. It's like a
Yep.
Tabletop role-playing game where sometimes someone has a really big round, and it is really cool, but also, you know, it takes 5 seconds in the game world. You just have to spend that 35-minute round of combat chatting with everyone else.
Yeah.
And Hakram realizes he's tired.
He's a little puckered out.
He says, I think I'm done for the night, Cat. And then he takes a nap. And Archer, without the sarcasm, I think everything here is completely straight because, well, considering the two people who are talking, it's very much not straight. But everything here is played completely honestly because Hakram was super impressive and is. Mm-hmm. And Archer comments, steady fighter, this one. And softly categories, the steadiest. And ain't that the truth? There is nothing certain in this world but the dead king and Hakram and taxes.
He is going to be by Cat's side until he gets a different name and isn't there anymore.
And the spell keeps going, and Hakram's snapping, Archer's waiting, Cat goes over to check on Masego, see how the spell's going, and, hey, so it looks bad, but you have to remember that bad boys are also sexy, right?
Right, yeah.
And Hunter moves his spear, and he's probably going to loose betray Cat and the gang and kill them all, and then kill the demon. Which, you know, it's not like this wasn't expected. It was an alliance of convenience, and the convenience is done. And so he kills them, but he's hot, and I openly admit to being the kind of person who's willing to forgive hot people basically anything.
Even if he gets an extra hand?
I mean, everybody needs help sometimes.
Hunter spits blood, and then the demon's hand finishes ripping its way out of his chest. Keep in mind, this line is fantastic, because there is no lead-up to this other than Hunter raising his spear and Cat getting jumpy about that. There's no, and here's the fingers, there's something on his chest, there's nothing except the first we hear of the demon's hand is the demon's hand finished ripping its way through his chest. It's great.
So when I was being, comically enthused about Hunter, it was a bit, and it was for the juxtaposition of this coming up, it was funny because it wasn't going to last a long time, and it's fine, okay? It's fine like a drop of demon blood on your hand.
Huh?
Or left wrist, as it happens.
That doesn't sound fine?
No, a drop lands on Apprentice's left wrist, and he just brings up his other hand, tip of the finger glowing red-orange, and with a hoarse scream, he cauterizes the skin.
The horse is back?
Easy. Huh. So the corruption did get him. Now he has horse vocal flaps.
It turns out it's not a demon of corruption, it's a demon of horse.
Okay, but all you have to do from that is say boo.
Actually, yeah, that's true. But think about it. The silver spears were all fused with their horses. The demon body was inside of a horse. The special demon stayed on the horse even when the infantry was coming. Or the special devil stayed on a horse even when the infantry was coming. There was that big horse abomination that Nock killed. It's a very horse-themed demon.
They got the demon from Callow?
See? Exactly. And
it would be, like, triumphant, I think. Mission of Return.
Yeah, maybe I've never returned.
To just invent a horse demon.
And then, to top it all off, the demon's about to be defeated here. No spoilers, but it is. And the first hint that salvation is coming here is the sound of hooves. Because Eris rolls up and just instantly defeats the demon from horseback with basically no effort.
Well, Eris spoke with a pleasant smile. Quite a mess you've made here, Squire. Which is a really good line, until you remember, and I know I didn't even catch this till the second time through, you might not have, and that's fine, but it wasn't actually the Squire who caused the mess.
What?
I don't remember who, but someone else actually started this whole thing. I think it was Nilan, right?
Let's not give up too much, because probably we will figure out who is to blame next chapter that we discuss. And that's because that is, unfortunately, as far as we can go today.
One sec.
Okay. Did you say your bit?
Yeah, I said that's all we can do.
Okay. Join us next time on Podcast Guys talking Erratic Errata, as we discuss
an irritated heiress,
a draw under duress,
and denying Ubwa rest.
Wait in their blood.
Oh, not wait in their pooling flesh scraps.
Wait in their pooling flesh scraps. Podcast Guys Talking Erratic Errata is a fan-made podcast discussing Erratic Errata as a practical guide to evil. Check out the full serial at practicalguidetoevil.wordpress.com. Intro music for this episode was Cradle of Your Soul by Lemon Music Studio. Dropping Objects was Objects Crashing.mp3 by Pixabay. Same sound twice, because we recycle. Scry Sounds was Warp, version 1, by Scheiden Beats Music. Music for the epigraph was Informa Conquerors of Ancient Lands. Windows Error Sound Effect was Windows Error Sound Effect by Pixabay. Running was Running by Pixabay. Outro music, which even now is elevating my voice to the realms of the divine, is Price of Freedom by Daddy S Music. Music is provided by the generous license of pixabay.com/music. Go and support all the artists who make this possible by providing their stories and sounds free of charge. If you'd like to support this podcast, follow us on Twitter at TheLongPrice. Do you have questions, comments, or contributions? Are you overwhelmed by the urge to correct our errors? Email us at TheLongPrice@gmail.com. If you'd like to materially support our work, find our Patreon. Look for it. It's somewhere. I'll give you a hint. Patreon.com/PGTEE. Join the ranks of our patrons and be called by name, receive personalized stories and art, and access a number of things, but none this episode. Sorry, we don't love you enough. We implore you don't consider joining unless you're already supporting the artists who make this all possible. Special thanks to our patron aunt, Villainous Hero Gray, our patron aunt, Liege, always the claimant, never the named, our patron aunt, Guardian, the Fae Knight, our patron aunt, Mentor, the Traveling Teacher, our patron aunt, dear friend, Aaron, our patron aunt, Inspiration, the Hopeful Romantic, as well as the Hordes of Cattle Below next week, Chapter 32, Draw.